So I've got to take everybody back 30 years, half my current age. And this all happened, this all started in January of 1987. I was one of just three full-time writers at Baltimore Magazine. This is an earlier era there. And we got news that there had been a major train crash in Chase, Maryland. A high-speed Amtrak passenger train had plowed into the back of three Conrail engines stuck in the switch outside Chase. So 16 people were killed, 175 were injured. At the time, it was the worst crash in the Amtrak history. And at the time, I also somehow thought that, you know, this is probably not going to be my story. The magazine didn't quite take on those types of stories. But I certainly had an appetite to do that sort of thing, to sort of redeem my misspent youth. In any case, I kind of bided my time. And what's interesting is that at the time, Baltimore Magazine and Washingtonian were owned by the same publisher, Philip Merrill. And we had a gathering of both magazines, and the editor of Washingtonian Magazine, Jack Limpert, said we should try to do the story together. And suddenly I was appointed to run the operation. And we had 90 days to put the story together. And I was excited about it. And I sort of used my techniques of what I call immersion journalism, where I had to flood the zone trying to talk to as many people as possible. So I amassed about 200 interviews over the course of that 90 days, in addition to my other magazine duties. And a lot of people with investigative reporting, they assume that a journalist is going to do a lot of what you would call seduction and betrayal of sources, where you're sort of going to gain their confidence and then somehow betray it when you sit down to write. I kind of felt like I was going to try to be a Boy Scout about it, and I always had this habit of saying that I practice seduction and delivery. In other words, I'm going to try to persuade you to tell me your secrets, and then I'm going to deliver them. And simply, if you're on the wrong side of the truth, I'll try to make sure that my readers are standing in your shoes. So the guys who were most on the difficult end of the story were the operators of the Conrail freight train. What was known at the time that when I started out my story effort was that these guys had marijuana metabolites in their blood when the investigators came around. Now that was a clue. It was interesting as to what an interesting clue as to what may have happened, but it was also quickly made clear that marijuana metabolites stay in humans' blood for 30 days. So it did not give any proximate explanation for why these guys went through a series of more than a dozen slow down and stop signals without stopping before they went into the high-speed track. So in the course of my reporting, I got to know not only the families and their grief, and I was camping out with them through a lot of difficult issues, but I also was immersing myself in the culture of the rails. And I gained the confidence of the engineers and the operators of both Amtrak and Conrail lines. And I rode the rails up and down the Northeast Corridor with them, including an overnight trip on a Conrail freight train. And it was interesting because I was starting to learn the pattern of what they talked about and what they cared about. I was able to say, you know, why is that dead man switch, you know, not functioning? Why is this train running without anybody, in the driver's seat? And I learned about this thing called the dead man switch. Why is the alerter whistle not signaling at all? It turns out that even on the train that I was on, the alerter whistle had been taped over, which was done out of habit because these guys used it to, it would wake up the brakeman who was often trying to sleep on an overnight shift. The brakeman was not supposed to be sleeping ever. In any case, in time, as we were amassing the story together, I had a command post that I'd set up in my Parkville condominium, in a little tiny place where I converted my master bedroom into our office filing space, and had my computer set up in there, and I had the assistant kind of working the files. In the middle of an afternoon, here I am doing kind of final fact checking, and I'm able to talk in kind of the pattern and the language and the idiom of what these guys do, and I'm talking with sources up and down the line. Now, I'm not going to be able to disclose, even after 30 years, who my actual pivotal source was in all of this. I can't even narrow the universe of possibilities down to help this person be found. But I was having this conversation with this person. I'll try not to even narrow it down by gender. And I was hitting on all these buttons about what I knew and how I was simply trying to piece these things together, and rattled off this stuff about, you know, I'm simply trying to understand whether these guys had the marijuana, blah, blah, blah. And suddenly this person started saying, well, you know, they had it here and Butch Cromwell brought the pot on the train, you know, and they lit up in the joint in the cab of the train minutes before the crash. And then as soon as they survived the crash, they got together and made up a cover story so they could lie to federal investigators. So I'm thinking, holy hell. I think we've just cracked the case. So I didn't say that to this person, but I did kind of very calmly put the phone down and finished up the conversation and walked in to see the assistant sitting with the files. And I said, holy hell, Steve, I think we've just been handed the holy grail to this thing. I think we really are really going to explain precisely how and why this happened. So we even posited a theory of the case, which is that marijuana is known to mess with a person's sense of time. 5 minutes can seem like a half hour can feel like 5 minutes. These guys had been through the gunpowder switch in this area 99 times in the previous year, according to our reporting. And they had an automatic sense of timing for what they were supposed to do with each slowdown and stop signal. But they got high. They were in a party mood. It was January 4th. They might have been listening to the radio with a playoff game, in the NFL that Sunday, and they had, you know, all these kids going back to college on their train. On the passenger train in the high speed rail, but these guys blew into the high speed track and caused the disaster. In any case, we come out with a story, we publish it, it ends up making national news. Because suddenly this whole story is understood, and it got the attention of a Senate inquiry panel, and these guys somehow understood that I had gained the confidence of a lot of the rail people, and that we might be able to get one of these people to testify in front of a congressional panel, which we did, and so I was able to deliver the brakeman to these guys, and actually sat and listened to his testimony. Well, it also became. It helped. That story helped change national law and mass transportation, so we now have random drug testing on the rails. The story was read into the congressional record as the official historical account of the disaster. It was it became a seminal piece in making the Supreme Court case in favor of random drug testing on the rails. And it was later serialized and condensed in Reader's Digest magazine and published 32 million copies worldwide in about 12 different languages. So it was a big deal. It launched my career. I did feel somewhat redeemed from my misspent youth. And it really kind of helped put Baltimore Magazine on the map in a way that I think, we were a very small, modest operation at the time. And I think, a lot of people were quite excited by what we had done. And so I now understand that story is available on the magazine archives online for the first time, I think, ever. So I'm hoping that some of you guys may actually be able to check it out and find out what we did and how. And now you know a little bit about how we did it. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.